Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Somewhere in the remote Saharan desert, a lost city known as Zerzura remains hidden. Many have searched following clues left in the sands, traces of an ancient legend. Join us tonight for episode 4, part 1 on Into the Portal, as we resume the search for Zerzura. Everyone, welcome back into the portal. My name's Andrew McKay.
And I'm Amber Ray.
And here we are, we're back again.
Yes. Episode four, part one.
And we've been looking forward to this one for a while, and I feel like it's taken us a little bit of time to put it together.
But definitely. But here we are. A lot of information.
Yeah. And we're excited because we're heading back into the desert. Which I didn't really think we were gonna head back to so soon. But here we are.
Just kinda happened.
Yeah. It really caught our eye, this one. It was like about lost cities in general for me, for
exactly.
Sure. I mean, it gets everyone going. Lost treasures, lost cities.
And then covering the Lost Army in our first episode, like, I feel like it was just really enticing. We kept getting little tidbits of this topic. So it was just like, we need to dive into this a little bit.
Definitely.
Further.
And if for listeners out there, if you haven't had a chance to listen to our first episode on the Lost Army of Cambyses, there's, like Amber said, lots of crossover to this episode.
Yes.
And
same neck of the woods.
Yeah, it would definitely contextualize some things to listen to that one, too. Not that it's necessary for this episode, but it's a good one for sure. we're back in the desert and looking for the legendary city of Zerzura, city oasis. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different interpretations.
Exactly.
And so, in the desert. And we wanted to give a little bit of a context of exactly where we're looking here.
Start off with some general details about the place.
Yeah. I mean, so obviously, Sahara Desert, largest desert in the world. It's like 3.5 million square miles, which would be, you know, just over 9 million square kilometers for us Canadians. And basically where we're dealing with is, you know, it's connecting from, it's southeastern Egypt. We got southwestern Libya.
No, we got that backwards. Southwest.
This is why we have a map.
Egypt, southeast Libya.
Correct. And then we got Sudan and Chad as well.
So it's really the junction of those three nations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a massive stretch of land that the explorers that we're going to cover in this first part, I mean, it took a while for them to get through even a fraction of it.
It was such a hostile terrain, too. Like, you know, you can't just...
Very much so.
Just walk out and just be like, all right. Well,
definitely.
Kind of need some equipment, need some
something.
some special stuff.
So, but basically how this episode one is going to go is we wanted to obviously contextualize the legend and then give the basis for the origin, the supposed origins, and then work our way through kind of
the more... We haven't
even
really said the name of the legend.
Well, of course we did in the intro.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
But obviously, that we're looking for Zerzura.
Yes, and, the lost city of Zerzura.
And, like, when we first started researching this, we came across a lot of stuff saying that this was referenced in Herodotus. So, once again, here we are going back to episode one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think it was Wikipedia
good
was the first one,
Herodi
obviously.
Dottie, right?
Yeah, classic.
Anyways.
And, obviously, Wikipedia, that page especially, was not... very well peer-reviewed or anything like that. So,
well, there wasn't a lot of in-text citations. There wasn't a lot of, just general references. No. It was kind of difficult.
So we would see that a lot in, like, blog-type stuff.
Exactly.
There's other things that would talk about
it. It was
Herodotus.
Almost as if they were, like, it was, like, a big circle where they were just feeding each
pretty
other.
Pretty much.
And, yeah.
With no actual primary source or anything like that. Or whatever.
Yes, we did try.
But basically, the idea was, was that Herodotus had mentioned a legendary city of Dionysus, or Dionysus, who is the god of wine, you know, entertainment, things like that. And something we didn't
Greek
really...
Greek god. And this is important because...
Yeah, this is something we realized that we didn't actually know for the first episode. And we kind of realized, when we were reading Herodotus, we were like, you know, these gods seem interchangeable.
He's referring to Amon in one sentence and then Zeus in the next. And we're like, wait a second, are you talking about two different oracles or two different gods? But no, he was actually equating them because he was taking the Egyptian version and then converting it and putting the Greek lens over top.
Yeah, just basically saying that the Egyptian perspective of Osiris is actually the Greek god Dionysus, and they just see it as Osiris and, you know, the Greek superior lens is how he was operating. But that I found that interesting. And so the connection there, like, we could not find anything in...
No, we could not find a reference to Zerzura.
Or a city of Dionysus, or a city of Osiris, quite frankly. But I looked into it a little bit more, and it was definitely interesting because... the idea that Dionysus was actually, like, more than just the god of wine and things like that. And it was actually related to the underworld. And there was cult religions that would sort of, you know, focus more on one god rather than the entire pantheon of gods. And this was existed in Egypt and in Greece and other cultures and stuff, too, that had multiple gods. Mm-hmm. Some would focus on one more than others. And so this is what happened with Osiris and stuff like that. So some people think that there could have been a... secretive religious rites kind of place for Osiris or Dionysus that may have been misinterpreted as Zerzura or as some type of remote thing, but couldn't find any conclusive thing to back that up.
We searched. We went through our whole freaking edition of that.
We really did. So the first reference came from Herodotus for us when we started this look, but we couldn't find
it. Fourth century BCE. So that's where we're starting off.
Right.
And then after that, we kind of jump ahead quite a few centuries back. We're into the 13th century now.
AD.
Yes, yeah. AD. So we're in the neck of the Middle Ages, and the reference came from a Syrian governor of a Fayum. So this is an agricultural center, the Fayum, and it was located approximately... it was about several hundred kilometers southwest of Cairo, just for reference point. We will have some maps up on our website as well, in the resource section or in the blog section. And so you can just reference that if you're kind of having a bit of a struggle to picture it in your head.
You definitely need maps when you're looking at some of this stuff. Like, it does get a little bit murky. So yeah, we'll have it up there for sure. But that's why we laid this part one out in this in an exact order of the kind of references, chronological order, because it's definitely easier to think of it that way.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating, the different expeditions and things that we're going to get into right in a sec. So yeah, 13th century reference.
Yes.
This was...
so it was a Syrian governor, as I already mentioned, and the reference was to an abandoned settlement called Zerzura.
Right.
Right. And so initially, we weren't really sure what to make of this because we did just see it on Wikipedia, and I was struggling to actually corroborate that, but I did find it referenced in a recent book. It was a political scientist called Jack Shanker, and this was kind of his breakout book. It's called The Egyptians, A Radical History of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution, published in 2017.
Cool.
So yeah, he references that, and then he also references our next mention here, which came in the 15th century now. So we're kind of jumping ahead again. So basically that was really brief, and it was just like, Zerzura. Yeah. So it was just like, oh, just something to grab onto from the past. And you're like, okay.
Yeah. These loose references to it.
But he never gave a location.
No.
As far as we could tell, it was just the fact that it was an abandoned settlement, which is very interesting. When we get into the theory section, that's definitely going to be something that we're going to touch on again.
Yeah, the idea of things abandoned and who it could have been that was abandoning it in the first place, or who may have filled it in after it was abandoned.
Well, that's just it, right? Like, what if, anyways.
Get ahead. Now, okay, we've gone through the first couple. This is where it starts to get real interesting. So, 15th century.
I love this story.
Very, very cool story.
Very far-fetched.
I think you should give it here because you're into it.
Well, all right. I can do that. So this comes from 1481. It was a camel driver by the name of Hamid Kalia, or Kiela. Anyways, so this guy, he was a camel driver, and he arrived in Benghazi. So this is Libya.
Yeah.
Totally weak, exhausted, on the point of death, essentially, with this tale of a white city that he He was saved by the inhabitants and basically nursed back to health.
Right.
So the story goes that he was initially in a group. They were a traveling caravan, and they got caught in a huge sandstorm that lasted about a week. And basically everyone was killed in his party except for him. He survived by basically sheltering himself under his dead camel. And so after the sandstorm, a week-long sandstorm, could you imagine? That's a gnarly sandstorm. Anyways, yes, that was crazy.
They do happen, though.
If this is a true account, we're kind of, I feel like this is evidence to, what was that guy's name in the first episode where he said, you can't die from a sandstorm?
Oh, Olaf Copper.
Yeah, Copper. Anyways. Yeah. So apparently people can die in sandstorms if this little tale has any credence.
Yeah.
So anyways, this Hamid Kila, he is saved by men that he describes as having Aryan features and straight swords. Not the Arab skimters.
The more rounded, curved exactly, swords. Exactly, yeah. Very distinct.
The ones that you see in Aladdin.
Yeah.
Disney reference. Anyways. Okay, so essentially what these people did was they brought him to a whitewashed city that was described as a paradise of sorts. And these were non-Arab people. They didn't have they didn't have the prayer call. That's what he definitely noticed. Like, you know, like the bell on the hour or whatever. And he also said that the women were not wearing headscarves. So very interesting. But he did say that they were speaking an Arab dialect of some sort that he was having issues understanding. They had to explain a lot to him. And even though it was similar, but not that familiar.
Right.
Anyway, so it kind of maybe points to that these people have lived in isolation, but they did have similar roots with the people in the area. Who knows?
Based on this story.
Yeah. Yes. So Kila is cared for by these people for about, I think he describes it as like a few months. And he's telling this all to, he's telling it to the emir of Benghazi. And so it was the scribes that actually recorded this. Mm-hmm. And as he's telling the story, the emir becomes more and more suspicious because he's wondering why the heck this guy showed up half dead in this place in Benghazi, and why would he have ever left if it was such a paradise?
Right.
So apparently, he decided to search him, and they found a great ruby ring that was set in a gold setting. So very valuable. It's like, how the heck would a camel driver ever get his hands on that?
Right.
And they were immediately suspicious that he must have stolen this from the people of Zazura. So anyways, I guess the Arab camel driver was sentenced to having his hands lopped off in retaliation for his crime of theft. And the ring supposedly stayed in possession of the emir and eventually came into possession of King Idris of Libya, who was eventually overthrown by Al-Gaddafi in 1969. So, yeah, very interesting. We'll get back to the ring in our theories part, because that is very mysterious. It's definitely not in the mainstream. No one knows where it is now.
No.
So,
I mean,
it's a very tumultuous part of the world, right? With all these revolutions that were occurring.
Yeah, like if you believe it did fall into the possession of Muammar Gaddafi, then presumably it would be... It either would have been stolen during his ousting or just misplaced, or it is still in the possession of whoever...
His family? Or right. On the black market? Maybe they sold it?
Possibly.
You never know.
If you believe this story to be true. Exactly. But it is a fascinating story. And there were references saying that it had been studied.
Correct? Yes. Yeah, it says that the ring itself was studied, and it was of 12th century European origins.
Very interesting.
Very curious.
Because, that ties into a lot of theories too. Like the idea of 12th century European origin being the optimal word there.
Right.
So.
So again, you get two European elements, right? You get the description of the inhabitants.
Right.
As being fair-skinned Aryan.
Right.
And with the straight swords and no Islamic sort of religious elements. But with the Arabic language. So anyways, very curious. It's very problematic in the whole larger picture, this one account.
Well, it's the only one like it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are other references to the, I believe, to the idea that the inhabitants were much more fair-skinned and weren't Egyptians or weren't who you would expect them to be, necessarily.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to that, too. But yeah, that's a really cool story. I mean, I just wish that ring was out there. that we could see it, that we could actually, or if there was some sort of even a secondary source, some other source from the 60s when Gaddafi took over, saying that this was in their possession or something as like a bragging about it or something.
Right?
You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, you think that would be something, but I don't know.
So that was the first 15th century reference.
Exactly. And another thing that sort of adds credence to this account is his description of the dove, right? It was like, there was the bird and the white walls. And he describes going through two wadis to get to this walled city that in the entrance there was this bird. So our next reference, again, is 15th century. Do you want to touch on that one?
Or? Yeah, I'll start it off. And, okay. But just to give some other context, too, because we'll be referring to wadis a bunch throughout this episode.
We should probably define what a wadi is.
So, like, a wadi is basically a non-permanent water source.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a seasonal water source.
Well, but it's like a carved, like, valley.
Valleys.
Or some sort of, like, a crevasse type thing.
Right.
So what I'm picturing in my head, because, like, we're going to be mentioning this plateau called the Gilf Kebir Plateau, and there is definitely, you can, like, Google Earth it, too, and just see all the different wadis that have basically been, like, carved into it by past waterways and seasonal waterways, too. So, anyways, so a wadi is a valley or some sort of, narrow opening in a plateau or whatever, and basically
would allow for water accumulation.
Exactly.
And the thing is like, when they say temporary, it makes it sound as if it would be like really quick, like a flash rain, and then there's like water there for a short period of time, but it actually could last like for years at a time. And so lots of people obviously in North Africa were nomadic peoples, because they would move from oasis to oasis or water source to water source, and so it's tough to kind of get a timeline on them because of that. But anyway, so we're moving on to the second 15th century reference. This is kind of the basis of the majority of this story.
It's kind of a linchpin.
This is the linchpin for the story. Mm-hmm. This was the source that Laszlo Almassi used, and others fell back on for searching for Zerzura.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Kitab al Kanuz.
Mm-hmm.
The Kitab al Kanuz. So translates roughly to the Book of Hidden Pearls.
Mm-hmm.
So, not to be confused with another text called the Kitab al-Bulhan, which translates to the Book of Wonders, or the Book of something similar to Wonders, basically. there's debate about the direct translation, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also an Arabic manuscript that's dating to the 14th century, and it is, you know, going over astrological signs. There's lots of drawings of animals, and some of it's super creepy and stuff like that. So not to be confused with that one,
known
animals.
Okay.
But some of the drawings were bizarre when I glanced over it.
Huh.
But we're talking about the Kitab al-Kanuz.
Mm-hmm.
So give us some goodies on that there.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's described as a treasure seeker's guide. It is an anonymous author, and some people actually ascribe Hamid Kalia's account, connecting that, because it was such close proximity time-wise, and they actually, there's some hypotheses that he is the author of the Book of Hidden Pearls.
Oh, okay.
So anyways, this book describes the locations of over 400 hidden treasures in Egypt alone, and how to discover them either by incantations, other occult means. There's definitely some pretty obscure directions, that type of thing.
Oh, that'd be so much fun.
Right? And so basically this is how the passage goes. It says here, this is a quote, "Situated behind the citadel of El Suri, you will see palms, vines, and springs. Penetrate into the wadi and pursue your way up it. You will find another wadi running westwards between the mountains. From this last wadi starts a road which will lead you to the city of Zerzura, of which you will find the door closed. This city is white like a pigeon, and on the door of it is a carved bird. Take with your hand the key in the beak of the bird, then open the door of the city. Enter, and there you will find great riches, and also the king and queen sleeping in their castle. Do not approach them, but take the treasure." End quote.
Very cool.
Isn't that sweet?
How could that not, that would get anyone going. Like, obviously, and the fact that it's an unknown author, too,
that just adds to
that.
Ugh,
it's like, that would just drive people nuts.
Yep.
And it totally did drive people nuts. Mainly the people from the Royal Geographic Society, who we will touch on in just a sec.
The Zerzura Club. Fascinating group of individuals.
So you said how many different treasures were referenced in that again?
Over 400.
400.
Yeah. So where are all these other guys?
You know, it sucks, though, because
any of them,
like,
have actually been discovered, right?
Yeah, I know, right? It's like,
ooh, we should look into that.
We really should. It's too bad, though, that the manuscript is not available.
That's the weird part, because we do get references into the 20th century from members of the Zazura Club,
yes,
/ Geographic Society,
yeah,
who claim
to have seen it.
Well, claim to have seen it, and also claim to have had it in their possession. So, the plot does thicken.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they kept it under wraps, and it's in, who knows who has it now.
I know, like a private collection.
You gotta wonder, because a lot of this stuff was happening in the, before the Second World War, too.
Yeah.
If any of it made it into the hands of the Germans, possibly in North Africa,
yeah,
or something like that. But who knows? It's missing, as of now. Nobody knows exactly where it is. But man, 400 treasures, that's just crazy.
Isn't that neat?
So anyway, that was the basis for a bunch.
And you get a very similar description of the city that came from Hamid's account.
Right.
The camel driver.
Yes.
So to me, that definitely makes it a little bit more plausible that he could have maybe been the author. But, you know, it's all conjecture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At this point, anyway.
Yeah.
So... But I mean, yeah. So, but people did take it seriously,
mm-hmm,
and so that kind of led into the 1800s, and this was the real beginning of, obviously, this was the British in North Africa, in,
mm-hmm,
Africa in general.
Colonial ambitions at its finest.
Exactly. Yeah. This was the imperialist century for,
mm-hmm,
sure. I mean, obviously into the 20th century as well. But 1800s, we have one of the first references to Zerzura from a Englishman,
mm-hmm,
and that was Sir Gardner Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm.
John Wilkinson, I believe was
John
his name.
Gardner
John
Wilkinson.
Gardner Wilkinson.
Yeah.
And that came in 1835.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy was in Egypt, and, you know,
he's traveling.
He
wrote a handbook for travelers in Egypt, which is what we're referencing, and we will have that available on our resource page.
It's really fascinating.
It's so cool. The whole book is available on Google Books.
For free.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And there's only a couple references to Zerzura, but it's the thing about this is, like, all of their work, all of this stuff, even if they weren't directly doing it for the purpose of discovering Zerzura, ties into the search for Zerzura, because
they're
finding different water sources, they're finding different caravan routes, they're going places in the desert that people had not
different
traveled to before.
That
yeah.
people didn't know if they actually existed or
exactly.
not.
They were rumors and myths, and they ended up being true. So why not Zerzura, right?
Exactly.
So 1835, there's a couple, what stood out to you then from Wilkinson? Like,
for me, with Wilkinson, the two different accounts, he references one account that places Zerzura 5 or 6 days west of the road to Farafa, which is an oasis, and it will be in the maps that we will be posting on our website. So if anyone wants to go and check that out, just pause this right now. If you're having difficulties, go on the website and just pull it up. And,
yeah, 2 seconds.
While you're listening, like, just, yeah, if you're like, hey, wait a second, what? Because they are very, very helpful.
Yeah,
that right
definitely.
Now. But basically, yeah. So there was the one oasis that was 5 or 6 days west of this road, and apparently this was discovered about at his time of writing. It was discovered 20 years ago by an Arab who was in search of a stray camel, and he saw several different footsteps of men and sheep. So he supposed it to be inhabited.
Right.
And so basically, this was an oasis that was abounding in palms, how he describes it, with springs and some ruins of an uncertain date.
Interesting.
Yes. So definitely a settlement of some type. And
yeah.
maybe it is the same settlement that was referenced by the 13th century Syrian governor of the Fayum. So,
the settlement of Zerzura.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyways, so that was one. And then he also has another account that he references, where Zerzura is only 2 or 3 days due west from Dakhla. And
okay.
we will see that reference quite a bit. There's a lot of credence to the idea that it would have existed or could have existed in the past, very, very near to Dakhla.
Right.
So, yeah, what about you, though?
Obviously it's interesting. It's always interesting to read something that was published in 1835.
Yes.
And
a lot of political incorrectness for today's.
I mean, obviously, yeah, it's super racist.
Yeah.
not a politically correct era at all. But interesting because obviously his account from people he had talked to was basically like, from the one reference that I have here was, you know, he had talked to talked to Arabs saying that they had never traveled that far, and that it was basically a land of like black giants, basically, yes. Right? And so we were like, what does that mean? And obviously that runs contrary to the earlier references from the camel, the camel driver, and from
with the fair skinned
encounters. And so a lot of people, including Laszlo Almassi later on, would think that this possibly could have been the Tibu peoples. Tibu.
We've seen several different
spellings. Who are nomadic North African peoples in North Sudan, Chad, and
maybe things just like in that. Comparison, they were quite a bit taller.
So well, they actually are. They are taller than other people in the region for sure. And
so you're not talking like fabled, like fairy tale giants.
No, not at all. But I mean, you know, whatever. Six taller than the average people in the area. So they would potentially be referenced that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's interesting because then that sort of makes you think about, well, could there have been an ancient African empire that existed predating the Egyptians, and that there's leftover remnants from that were so remote.
Yeah.
And so that sort of ties into that. And we'll get to that obviously much, much more detail for in the theories in the second part of this two-part series here.
Yes.
But yeah, that was an interesting reference from Wilkinson for me, because obviously that's the first one from an Englishman, and it's different than the other accounts. It's different than the Kitab al-Qanuts that Almassi, another European, would end up following.
Yeah.
So.
Very curious.
Interesting for sure. Mm-hmm. So then later on, 1874, we've got another guy. So it's a German explorer, yeah. Gerhard Rolfs. And lots of Europeans, man. They're adventurers, them Europeans. Obviously Germans, they're climbing mountains and doing crazy things. So they're into venturing into remote, uncharted Saharan desert.
Let's just say this right now. Like, this is pretty early. Like, we're still in the 1800s. But into the 1900s especially, this area became of strategic importance for political purposes.
Very much so.
Obviously, we already mentioned the colonial ambitions of all these nations.
Yeah.
There was definitely competing interests for resources. Oil.
Big time.
So things like that definitely added to the allure of just exploring the area in general. So a lot of the accounts, especially from the Zazura Club and the Geographic Society that we'll reference, it was almost as if they had a dual purpose. And they did want to establish a precedent. They wanted to have their people in there. So like when war broke out, say like World War II,
yeah,
they had it in their back pocket.
Well, there was two parts of it. There was a source of pride for a country to have discovered something before another country.
Exactly.
And there was strategic importance for getting them in there. And I feel like a lot of the times, obviously, governments would recognize the ambition of a lot of these adventurers and would
and
use it
them.
To their advantage.
Yeah.
And whether they, I mean, they're not stupid people. They probably knew that it was for political purposes, but
they were taking
funded.
Advantage of it too.
It got them funded and they could
exactly.
go do these things, right?
Yeah.
So that's what the era was like. And I mean, it's very similar today. Not in the same sense of imperialism, but if you're looking for funding to go somewhere to do something, then it's going to have to benefit someone else too.
Exactly. And that was what Almaji really depended on. He needed his patron.
Yeah.
Prince.
And
what was his name again? Prince
We have Kamal, it down here somewhere.
Kamal Al-Adin or something?
Yeah, we'll get to him in a sec.
Yes. So anyways, we're heading back to 1873-74 with this German explorer, Gerhard Rolfs. So this guy, he basically was starting off from Dakhla in this particular journey. So this is the oasis of Dakhla. Again, reference those maps.
Yeah.
And he was trying to cross the desert. He was trying to cross the Great Sea of Sand and get to Kufra, which was located in Libya.
Yeah.
So I would say that's probably like the southeastern quadrant of
it's
Libya.
It's super remote. Like Kufra Oasis is very, very hard to get to.
Very hard. So basically he failed the first time and they couldn't traverse the high dunes. They ended up building a cairn, so basically a monument of stones.
Yeah.
And they designated it the Regenfeld to mark the end of his journey. And this was rediscovered by the Zazura Club in the 1900s. But Rolfs, he didn't give up, eh? He came back.
Not a quitter.
1879, he becomes the first European successful in making it to Kufra from the north. So from the Mediterranean, I don't know if he would have actually crossed through Siwa. We definitely mentioned Siwa in our first episode, but that was a very northern oasis in Egypt.
Yeah.
Kind of bordering Libya too, so yeah, northeast Egypt. And anyway, so yeah, he would have come from there and basically it would have been like a, not a parallel trajectory, it would have been a
diagonal.
Diagonal, thank you. Yeah, and so he basically, yeah, that was a pretty big achievement
Definitely.
For the time.
Well, that's a ridiculously long way. And Siwa's already super remote, too.
I wonder what he was using for, like, was he in a caravan? Was he using camels?
He had to have been using a small, he had to have had a small group. It was probably a camel caravan.
Because it wouldn't have been cars
at
this point.
No, not at this point in time. And no. I mean, they struggled with cars at the turn of the century, too. And when they were using Model Ts and jacked them up and had different techniques. But it was tough. They struggled in
building
the sand.
Tracks, deflating the tires so that they could... what was that for again? That was to just help not, they wouldn't have sunk into the sand?
I guess, because there was different, they would run into different densities of sand. Some would be softer, some would be more compact, some would be, and they would hit different temperature changes. They'd be traveling different times of the day and the sand would change and the tires would change. Obviously, they'd heat up, so they would end up, there was a lot of different techniques.
So it was definitely a science and they were pioneering it. Yeah. So, a lot of struggles.
Very much so. So he, but again, another European made great headway, and he, all these people are setting stepping stones leading up to what would be incredible discovery. I mean, they're discovering incredible things too, but would lead up to really profound Zerzura related discoveries in
the 20s. It's so funny because
they
seem so insignificant on their own, but then when you sort of like piece it all together, you see the whole picture.
Yeah, and
it's really neat. Yeah,
very cool. It makes me believe that this place did exist.
Yes.
And there's evidence for it, and we're going through it right now. So this would set the stage for the Zerzura Club.
Yeah. So the Geographic Society funded expeditions. They called themselves the Zerzura Club.
Yeah.
And they basically referenced the Kitab al-Kunuz for their source.
Yeah.
Or the Book of Hidden Pearls, as we discussed. And there was quite a crew, and it was kind of funny when I first discovered this. We do have links to all the articles. It's kind of difficult, too, because a lot of these are from academic databases, so you need either to be a part of an institution, or you can sign up through JSTOR, and they actually have a free program where it's completely free. You can sign up, and you can have up to 3 free PDFs or articles on your bookshelf at one time, and you can remove those, so you can keep, like, swapping them out. So you, even if you didn't go to university or whatever, you can gain access to these, which is really fun. And
yeah,
I was just reading through these. They're very short. They're like max 5-6 pages a piece. And it's almost like they're bickering. They're fighting back and forth. They have their own hypotheses and things. And it's just
They all wanted to be the one to find it.
Yeah.
They all wanted to be that one.
But it's funny because they all added to the whole puzzle. And it was just all these little tiny pieces and things. I don't know.
Was constantly being added to. There was always new information. Yes. There was always new discoveries and interpretations of old discoveries.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a big part of this. Reinterpretations of old discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
That plays a big role
So, okay, who would you say is the first to kind of make headway into this?
Well, I think,
stick to chronological,
I'm sticking to chronological, but this is also, I mean, it's in order chronologically, but it's definitely one of the more important people, I should say. Lieutenant Colonel N.B. Delancey IV.
Right.
I don't actually have a reference as Military to where
man.
This guy was from. Was he British?
Yeah, he was British. Yeah. These were all British because the Geographic Society was British.
Yeah, the Royal Geographics, Royal Air Force, Royal this, Royal that, of course.
And that's kind of an important note, too, because we did touch on the whole, like, political significance of the area.
Yeah.
And these were military men, for the most part.
True.
And during World War II, they all formed, what was it called? It was the, some sort of, like, guard of the desert, and they, like, basically did patrols
and all this
stuff.
It was, like, what was it called? I have it down here in a sec. The Long Range Desert Group. That would eventually be a significant part of the British campaign against the Germans in the Second World War.
Right.
Anyway. So, but this guy, Lieutenant Colonel N.B. Delancey IV, it was interesting. He did expeditions in 1921, 23, and 24. And he didn't really find too much in terms of, like, ruins or pectoglyphs that other people would end up finding later on. But he did notice certain things, same sort of things that I think Pasha Johnson, is that the name?
Johnson Pasha.
Correct? Johnson Pasha, regarding the birds.
Yeah.
So he was traveling and he discovered some of these caravan routes, and he was traveling west of Dakhla too, I believe. And basically noticed flocks of birds flying in the direction that is not where they should have been going.
Mm-hmm.
Like directly towards where there's no water, as far as anyone knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kept along their journey, And further along, they ended up, I don't know if they actually shot one of these birds or they found deceased birds or whatever, but they ended up dissecting multiples of them.
I think the account I heard was that they just found a dead one.
They found a dead one. They dissected it, and lo and behold, they've been feeding on olives.
Mm-hmm.
Not from the olive groves that they knew of in the West. It's clearly, too far away. Clearly from olive groves that they did not know of. Which obviously led them to believe that there was water sources that they did not know of way further west.
Mm-hmm.
So this was an indication that there was much more to be seen water source wise, and led, you know, gave credence to Zerzura and other oases in general and other wadis that had supposedly dried up.
So he was basically discovering bits of the Abu Balas Trail, the caravan route that basically went. It was a southwest trajectory from Dakhla.
Yeah.
So from Dakhla down, passed through the Gilf Kabir into the interior Chad Basin.
Right.
And again, we do have a map, and it does show you exactly where that trail was. So if you're curious.
Is that same caravan route from the first episode? Or was that a different caravan route from Siwa? Or does it extend the whole way down?
It does extend, yeah. Obviously, there would have been a few different ones.
Yeah, or they may have intersected at certain points
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly, yeah.
But they were way longer than people thought they were.
Yeah.
And it was like, we mentioned that in episode one, Almasi finding pots.
So the birds.
Yeah.
At what point were they found, I wonder?
That was the thing. I tried to find it. Presumably this was, it
I guess
was obviously
you wouldn't have known which direction the dead bird was flying.
It was, well, they were flying west. They were flying southwest, into territory towards what would be, this is eastern, southeastern Egypt, and you're going to be getting into sort of central western Libya, central
so
eastern Libya.
So they were
Libya,
coming from the north of Egypt then.
Yes.
So that, honestly, like, that could have been, depending on where he was, the exact location, which we don't have, I feel like it wouldn't be a stretch to say that the birds maybe could have come from Farafa, which
it's
was
possible.
Known for having olive
it's
groves
possible.
And stuff.
It's possible. And I think that's what some of the rebuttals to his writings have
I do
been.
Remember the other guy, you know. That dude.
Pasha Johnson.
Yeah, he basically, he described finding a bunch of dead birds.
Hmm.
And, like, again, yeah, he definitely was of the same mind that this was a strange migrational route.
It had to have been.
And then that kind of leads into the idea that the actual name of Zerzura is derived from the Arabic word zazuras, which is actually so it's Arabic for little bird.
Right.
So in that sense, it almost seems like that could have been a different version, or maybe it was more natural. Because in my mind, I'm almost picturing two different places. I'm picturing this magnificent walled city that's like hidden in some secretive wadi valley or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I'm also picturing something that's a lot more natural and a lot more
just
maybe it was just filled
farmed.
With birds and, you know, and that's why it's called Zerzura. Zerzura, you know,
it just happened to be a water source that was significant.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I just keep going back and forth on that regard, but
I think it could have been both. And we'll come to that in the theory.
Okay. So this Johnson Pasha guy, he's very interesting too, because he was the one that claimed to have the Book of Hidden Pearls in his possession.
That's right.
And that he apparently loaned it to the Department of Antiquities in 1905 for translation, but he doesn't say whether or not he actually got it back or where it is now. Or
what Department of Antiquities is he referring to?
Good question. Is it the I think it was the Egyptian.
I mean, at the time, obviously, the Egyptian Department of Antiquities would have been the British Department
exactly,
of Antiquities.
Exactly. The British colonial,
Egyptian Department of Antiquities.
There you go.
Something like that.
very official.
But that's not clear. So we don't really know. The other thing about, sorry, just to go back to Delancey, that was significant, not just the birds. He did find other things, right? Like he found sort of evidence of Neolithic habitation in the West, flint implements, evidence of ancient campfire fragments, evidence of petrified...
Things to grind grains?
Yep, things to grind grains, petrified ostrich and oyster shells in certain areas that people had obviously...
Ostrich?
People had obviously...
Sorry, ostrich bones or ostrich...
Bones, like petrified, like remnants of an ostrich skeleton, I presume.
So not the
presumably.
Eggs, the actual bird.
The actual, yeah, petrified. Oyster shells, presumably from trade, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is significant. Obviously, he's adventuring further along these caravan routes. And finding Neolithic habitation is important because obviously we know that, you know, Africa's the cradle of civilization and there's obviously people there.
Neolithic period basically was pre-Egyptian, pre-ancient Egyptian culture.
Yeah, this was like almost stone. This was like Stone Age.
Yeah.
Stone Ages.
Very.
But it's obviously, we have this conceptualization of the Stone Ages as exactly what that name, like the connotation of that name, Stone Ages. What do we say when somebody's playing it old school today, be like, you're back in the Stone Ages. But it's like, we don't know to the extent
how significant. We're not saying that it was a primitive culture by
exactly.
any means,
because that's it was what it, within that time. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he found some significant things, for sure. We're moving on. Now we're moving on. So.
So this is all in the 1920s, hey?
Yeah. Like, this was the heyday.
It really was.
This was the heyday.
It was the fever. It was like the gold rush of Zizzera.
It really was. Mm-hmm. And the gold rush of just like searching for lost stuff in general.
Yeah.
You know, like out in searching for El Dorado and things in Central America, South America.
It was a time of great optimism. Even after, well, maybe not so much after the First World War. I don't know.
Maybe not.
People were trying to forget that, you know, the 20s was the roaring 20s. Yeah. So it was a fun time to be around. There was lots of money. There was lots of, just adventure and just a sense of putting the past behind you. And yeah.
Right.
Just, anyways.
So the next reference I have here is from, so it's actually, it's a 20s reference, but it's a 1933 newspaper article about a lecture at the University of Hong Kong by a Major Ralph Bagnold, who was a British Army officer and ended up leading the long-range desert group during the Second World War because of his experience in the desert. And he operated in the 20s and 30s,
mm-hmm.
so he had different expeditions in 1920. He was also a member of the Royal Geographic Society as well, and he would go on to critique Almasy and P.A. Clayton's work.
Mm.
So he had an expedition in 1929, and basically every few years they're pushing further. They're pushing further than...
Well, but even before that, right? Like the Prince Hussein Kamal al-Din, this is 1923-24, right?
Right, actually, we're kind of jumping ahead. So in his lecture, he references this 1923, that's right. So Ahmed Hassini Bey. So he was an Oxford-educated Egyptian diplomat, and he actually was an Olympic athlete, too, apparently, in fencing. I don't know how he did.
Crazy.
But, yeah. So 1922-23, and basically he worked under King Farouk, the king of Egypt at the time, and he ventured into the Saharan Desert in remote parts of the Libyan Sahara, moving from the Mediterranean coast, traveled south to Kufra. He apparently employed...
To kind of retrace the steps of the Rolf guy.
Yes,
from the
he was basically taking that same route as him and then trying to push slightly further than that.
Uh-huh.
So supposedly he had employed the services of some nomadic African peoples. It was not specific exactly who they were, possibly the Tibu peoples.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first Egyptian at the time to have discovered the Ulanat mountain range.
It's a modern discovery.
Modern discovery of the Ulanat mountain range. So there were legends of the Uinat Mountains, and people sort of knew they loosely existed even in the time of Herodotus, but people never went there. So
and
it was never...
This mountain range in particular becomes very significant as just a place marker.
Yes.
And just a reference point for everyone else going in after this.
Very much so.
Yes. And basically, yeah, like even Prince Hussein Kamal al-Din, who was Almazi's patron, he did his own exploring in the 1920s, and he basically... Yeah, he went to the spot. This was in 1926.
Okay.
And even before that, though, in 1924, he basically retraced again the Rolf, the guy, the German dude.
Right.
And he rediscovered in February of 1924 the cairn and the monument called Regenfell. So that's kind of cool, eh? He's
very
just kind of
cool.
Like, oh, yeah.
Found
and then
the
he
marker.
Also, yeah. And then in his second journey in 1926, he made it to the Uinat Mountains. And he started from Dakhla, and he used the Abu Bas Trail that had, the parts of it that had been discovered.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot more to discover that
totally.
They didn't know about.
Yeah.
And that won't come until much later in the 20th century. But anyways, yeah, so he just basically made some more inroads into the area. And that kind of, like, fueled his passion for continuing with Almazi in the 1930s.
Right.
Until his death in 1932.
Definitely.
Yes. So I guess another person that would be significant to mention at this point would be... Harding King, W.J. Harding King.
Yeah. Yeah, he was definitely significant. Yeah. What do you have for him? I mean, he makes, okay, like, here's what I got. So, like, Harding King, I mean, he's struggling with cars. He's struggling to use motor vehicles, and so yeah. He ends up doing the majority of his work with camel trips out of Dakhla. He took several different routes in his expeditions, 200 kilometers southwest of Dakhla in 1909.
Exactly. Yeah, he was an early one. We should have mentioned him off the bat, really, because he made huge inroads in map making, and he discovered Two Peaked Hill, which was by the Uinat Mountain Ranges.
Right.
So that, again, is another significant point.
And I believe he discovered pectoglyphs. Like, the first guy, Ahmed Hassini Bey in the 2223, I think when he got to the Uinat Mountain Range, that he found pectoglyphs too. And pectoglyphs are basically, just for people who don't know, similar to, like, it's not a drawing, it's an etching. So it's literally carved out of the rock. So as opposed to using a type of ink or paint or whatever, yeah. So it's actually like an etching right into the rock, and he found ones that were similar to what would be discovered later on, but depicting, life that presumably never existed in that area.
Yeah.
Animals that didn't, giraffes, hippopotamus, people living there.
That's so crazy.
And
Al-Mazi, he'll make more discoveries in that regard, and same with the later Bergman as well.
Indeed.
But another interesting thing about Harding King was that, he did make several camel trips out from Dakhla, and he made it 200 kilometers basically southwest. And anyways, his attempts to go further than this two-peaked hill that he discovered, it was, quote, thwarted by a native guide loyal to the Senussi who tampered with his water supplies.
Right, yeah.
Which is crazy. But even despite that, he managed to make a pretty accurate map of the Libyan desert based on information gathered from natives. And he included this oasis of Oanat, so another oasis. Yep. There's so many out there. And also, he made the prediction at this point that there was going to be more oases somewhere roughly 400 kilometers to the southwest of Dakhla based on the stomach content of migrating birds. So once again,
these birds.
Get the evidence. Yes, the birds. The birds.
So
the
just to recap, we've got the translation of Zerzura involving birds. So, like, it means little bird. We've got the reference from Delancey birds, Johnson Pasha with the birds, and now again.
And Harding King. So they're all pretty focused on birds, which is actually very accurate though, right?
That's it ties into it.
It's not far-fetched,
not
right?
At all.
By any means. But anyways, it was so funny. All these guys, they had like little points of contention. Like there was one guy's name was Ball. I can't remember his first name. But basically, he had a little spat with King, disagreeing on the assessment of water levels and whether or not there could have been an oasis that existed based on the sandstone and clay deposits and all this stuff. And those were kind of thrown out later in the 20th century, so I'm not going to really dive into that too heavily. But basically, Ball got pretty frustrated with King, and he basically got to the point where he just concluded Zerzura was pure myth. And this is a quote from him.
What a dick.
I know. He says, quote, "We must conclude that the lost oasis of Zerzura has no more real existence than the Philosopher's Stone," end quote.
We must conclude it.
We must.
Okay, buddy.
Right? Yeah. Anyways. So anyway, yeah.
What a buzzkill.
And then, it's so funny, just, that's almost a reference to our third episode where we're like, hey, maybe this Philosopher's Stone was something.
Or had basis in something, right?
Exactly.
No, the evidence that we've seen so far, like, would run contrary to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically what people, all we've seen so far up until the late 1920s is people didn't think water sources existed, and sure enough, they still do. And ancient ones, even earlier than the ones that these people were finding in the 20s, may have existed as well.
Yeah.
So it's just constant. Every 100 kilometers you go, you're proved wrong, basically. So, okay, I'm back to Major Bagnold now because I kind of skipped ahead to that guy.
Bagnold!
Okay, so he was in the 20s, late 20s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
He was a military guy again as well. Mm-hmm. But I'll dial this in. I'm not going to talk about him for a long time. He discovered a lot of stuff, and one of the things was pectoglyphs as well.
Mm.
Because he basically discovered the Mordi Depression. is what it's called. So it's basically like a canyon kind of a thing in what is now Chad, like North Chad.
Ah, yes.
So,
and that could have been the location of these ancient paleo lakes that we'll get to in our theories exactly. section, part two. So
yeah.
stay tuned.
There's a lot of, yeah.
There's so much.
So much.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but he found this Morty Depression. Nobody had gone that far before, and he basically, this was one of the most significant Saharan grazing grounds for North Sudan and Chad and these types of areas and lower, that area.
Mm-hmm.
And other Arabs didn't know of it. People did not know of this before.
Hmm.
And he found pectoglyphs there. So these were some of the first ones, like giraffes.
Okay, so animals more animals. That were,
more animals and more, obviously, depictions of people. More depictions of was people there... living there. And they were found at wadis. There was more wadis, around this Morty Depression. And there's all these water sources, and there's clearly Neolithic implements being found, and then mm-hmm. possibly, you know, the actual pectoglyphs, whether they're directly associated with those Neolithic implements or not, I don't know. But there were people there.
Yeah.
There was civilization there. You know, mm-hmm. and it's crazy. It's really cool.
That is really neat.
So that was his contribution, and he was a part of the Geographic Society. He went on to critique Almasy and Clayton's work, and I guess we're kind of moving into those two right now.
Yeah.
So give us the lowdown on Almasy and Clayton.
Yeah, so we've basically covered, in our first episode we did touch on Almasy a bit.
We did.
He was a Hungarian researcher, desert enthusiast, described as one of the last of the romantic geographic adventurers. And again, it
the basis of the movie The English Patient, which I actually have mm-hmm. not read, but
yes.
I probably won't, to be honest with you. But
and we actually do have this really neat book that we're featuring in our bookstore, and it is the true story of the search for Zazura, which included Almasy.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, he basically started exploring the Libyan desert in the 1920s, roughly 1926. He was inspired by, again, the Kitab al-Kanuz, the Book of Hidden Pearls. And he was determined that he would find Zazura in the western side of the Gilf Kabir Plateau.
Yeah.
So this is a lot further south than previous theories and things.
Because
we've seen a lot of sources pointing to, say, west of Farafa, west of Dakhla.
Yeah.
They don't say southwest, they say west.
They just say west.
Anyways.
So this is the difference basically between if you're picturing the Nile River...
Mm-hmm.
This is the difference between going halfway down the Nile from the furthest possible northern part, so like literally mm-hmm. halfway down in eastern Egypt, and heading west. This is the difference between that and heading much, much further south between basically
literally
when
to the
you
border.
Are right on the tri-border of Libya, Egypt, and Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all desert. I mean, it's all remote.
It's all desert. And Almasy, he was pioneer, especially in regards to his method of transport. Like we've already mentioned, he was a pioneer traversing these dunes. He had a special way of like speeding up and slowing down depending on the point of the slope that you were on.
Yeah.
He also, again, pioneered the whole, like, the deflating of the tires to help
with the grip.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Genius, really.
And he also was the first to combine road, like, vehicles, like Ford, whatever, the Model Ts, and aircraft.
Right.
And it was so funny, actually. He ended up buying this aircraft. It was just, like, a teeny tiny little... what I'm imagining to be like similar to like a Cessna or something like that.
Yeah.
And basically he was flying it with one of his partners and they crashed and they almost died. Like they're actually
crazy.
They were declared dead. Like they were supposed to be meeting people for an expedition and it was called off because they thought that they were just
gone.
They
were like, they're gone.
But they ended up surviving and they reconstructed the plane and used it in their 1932 search. So basically, yeah, he was accompanied by Sir Robert Clayton, this other guy, a wing commander called Pendrell, so that was his pilot.
Right.
And then this Patrick Clayton, who was a surveyor, and he made significant map-making inroads as far as the Gilf Kabir. He went there in the late 1920s and mapped out a huge portion of the western side, and then that's what they used as a reference point when they went in there to search for the actual place, for Zazura.
Right.
So, anyways, this was kind of cool. I found a 1932 Geographic Journal article from Patrick Clayton.
Okay.
And basically, it's a pretty lengthy quote, but I feel like it's significant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely is. Let's do it.
Okay. All right, ready?
You got this.
Whew. All right. So, quote, from Clayton. On our return to the airplane, it was decided to use up the whole emergency reserve of the petrol in two short flights, enabling all four of us to record our impressions of the Wadi. A careful examination has made it possible to plot the head of the Wadi on the map. So this is a Wadi that they had spot. Sorry, I'm end quoting. This is a Wadi that they had discovered from the air in one of the first days of their search. And so on the last day, this is what they decided to use up. That's why they decided to use up all the reserve petrol so that they could, because they were already on their way back. They're like, they hadn't discovered anything, but they had made, sort of discoveries. Like they had discovered more, more petroglyphs and things like that. So basically, they went into the plane and, I'll pick up the quote here. So, quote, a careful examination has made it possible to plot the head of the Wadi on the map within 3 or 4 kilometers, and it turned out to be much nearer to the scarp than noted during the duration of the first flight had led us to believe. It could easily on foot be reached on foot from a camp below the scarp near where we climbed the path. This is kind of, is this a little bit?
No, keep going. This.
It's just a little bit obscure. It's hard to picture.
It's a bit obscure, but that's okay. Keep going.
So basically, this quote again, we consider it certain that this Wadi is one of those whose existence and occasional occupation by Arabs has given rise to the legends of the Wadi Zazura and the Wadi Abd el-Malik, which was a derivative of that.
Okay.
So anyways, it derives its water from the occasional rainfall on the Gilf Kabir Plateau and not from the source of artesian wells of the oases. At present, this district, like the Uinat, has had no rains for several years, but water would almost certainly be available in such a wadi for a year or two after rain. So again, that's what you referenced.
Lasts longer.
Like, it doesn't, it lingers.
Yeah.
And it might be in the ground, but it's still there. Anyways.
Well, of course, these petroglyphs they're finding indicate that, in fact, that the water sources at the time, whether these petroglyphs are Neolithic or just after Neolithic period in the transitionary period, if there's giraffes and animals like that there, those water sources are lasting for more than a year to 2 years.
And this is really significant here because he goes on to say that they had found fresh wild sheep tracks in the district. So it may be that there is water to be obtained.
Right.
And you know what's funny too? Like even in all these accounts where it's like, even Wilkinson, when he's like, oh, like this was discovered 20 years ago by an Arab that was like wandering after a stray camel. It's like, hey, wait a second, maybe that camel knows there's water somewhere. Maybe he's actually going somewhere.
Well, if they're already super, super remote.
Yeah.
And maybe some sort of unfortunate situation comes up. We were talking about this. Like a camel, they're desert creatures. Like just like a bird in the same sense, like they know where they're going. They have this evolutionary instinct. It's almost like the, what was it called, where people are trying to find water with the stick. They got the kind of
that
thing where they're trying to find water. I can't remember what it's called, but anyway.
But it's legit.
It's like animals.
They used it in California, the pioneers, too.
That is innate in animals.
Mm-hmm.
And if a camel wanders off, like, it's gonna head, presumably, in the right direction.
Presumably.
Not necessarily, but...
So it's kind of unfortunate, like, these guys, they went on this expedition in 1932, and then the following year, because they did plan to come back and just sort of pick up where they left off, but 2 out of 5 ended up dying, including Prince Kamal al-Adin, and then, the Patrick dude.
Well, Clayton died.
Not right? Patrick Clayton.
Didn't the first Clayton pass away, and then the other Clayton was the only one? I can't remember.
Because there's two Claytons.
Here's the thing.
Sir Robert Clayton East Clayton was the one that died.
Okay.
And Patrick Clayton survived.
Right.
And
that's
why you actually have this account from him. And he served in the long, what was it called? The long range.
Desert. Oh, yeah. Okay.
The desert long range. Long
range desert group for designed for combat missions, World War II.
So this is, so basically... Al-Mazi did go back, though. He did, he found the cairn of Regenfeld, that was found by predecessors of his as well, including Prince Kamal al-Din, who had apparently left a note at Regenfeld.
And this, just to be clear, Kamal al-Din was the primary source of funds for all of this.
Yes.
He funded all this. Al-Mazi was not wealthy.
No.
They needed this guy, and after he passed away, and the first Clayton passed away, it definitely became tougher.
It did. And he even, it's funny, when they went back, he actually made a memorial at the Gylf Kebir. He erected a memorial to the prince. And then he also apparently discovered rock paintings on boulders above this spring that was basically at the Uinhart Oasis. Right. So he's discovering a little bit more. And again, yeah, this is 1933. He discovers a great number of new sites. Most importantly, the two painted shelters at Wadi Sora and many unknown engravings and paintings at Kakar Tal, which is just, it's within the Gylf Kebir. Yeah. Just, these are all really obscure little references. Yeah. But yeah, so he's basically, he made some inroads. We actually have some photos too of him. Like there's one of him standing in that cave where there's all the paintings and stuff, which was kind of interesting, I thought. But
the petroglyphs and the paintings and things that he found were definitely, like, they were, to me, more profound than some of the earlier ones, even though they were, like, animals and stuff like that, because they were more indicative of human habitation.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Cave of Swimmers. Did you come across that?
No.
So, the Cave of Swimmers is what it's known as, but this was one of Almasi's, this was the Gylf Kebir Plateau, and this was not petroglyphs, but paintings, rock paintings, and yeah, Almasi discovered these, and this is what they look like here. They're like swimmers, human swimmers, and so it's called the Cave of Swimmers, and it's basically depicting these humanoid creatures, or human-like depictions, clearly swimming, like it's pretty awesome, and we'll have that picture up on the website, and you guys should check it out.
So, what body of water were they swimming in?
what are y'all swimming in, guys? probably not the sand, presumably. no. You might get a little chafing going on there, but yeah.
Might have so, been
so yeah, that definitely added to the. I mean, they're yeah, really interesting paintings. Like, go take a look at these pictures, and we'll have those up.
It's kind of funny too, because when we watched a documentary on the Lost Army. Remember that one? It was like from that geologist in the early 2000s or mid 2000s.
Yes.
And they had an individual on that was a contemporary of Almasi. And he was saying that basically Almasi took what he thought to be the location of Zazura to his grave. And he didn't tell anyone, but he claimed to have known.
He claimed to have known.
But he got distracted. Yep. He got distracted by the war.
Yeah. The Second World War definitely kind of buggered things up a bit.
Yeah.
The, you know, one of the interesting things that I sort of saved part of it for the, for the part two theories section. But I'll make mention of it now because Almasi, you know, he wasn't just venturing and doing these, you know, expeditions. He was doing a lot of anthropological work, like interviewing people and talking to people.
Hmm.
And he, you know, in the 1930s, the Italians were occupying a lot of North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the Fafra Oasis was one of those locations. And despite it being super remote, the Italians had made it that far and used it.
Hmm.
And so some of the peoples had kind of, whether you want to call them refugees or not or whatever, they had moved away.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of these elderly people Almasi had talked to, and I think this was 1933, can't remember if that's exactly correct, but anyway, he's talking to this elderly gentleman, Arab gentleman, and basically describing how he's asking him questions about what parts of this desert are Arab. You know, what parts are you familiar with, and what is Arab and what isn't?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy basically told him that, you know, there's a significant part of the desert that's Arab, that's Egyptian, that's this, that's that, but that there's sections that belong to the Tibu people.
Mm.
And these areas are remote, and they speak of it as their grazing grounds, but it doesn't belong to the Arabs.
Tibu. So maybe we did mention it.
We mentioned them briefly.
Yes.
But this idea that there's these, that obviously gave Almasi it was a little bit of fuel for him because there was obviously areas that even people who had occupied Fafra, which is super remote, there was even areas more remote than that they would say, that's not ours. Mm. That belongs to peoples of other North African origin.
Interesting.
And I found that to be pretty interesting from Almasi. And we'll come back to that in the theories. But
yeah, that's super relevant for just, yeah, exactly, more of the theoretical part. And then also, as well, that definitely ties into our last sort of account that came from the 1980s onwards into the early 2000s. And this was from Carlo Bergman. So I have a little brief bio on this guy. He has his own website. It's called carlo-bergman.de.
The funny thing about this guy, so, like, we thought, we were like, oh, he's got to be, like, he's some sort of an Austrian archaeologist or something. It's like, no, he's just, like a super eccentric explorer.
Yeah.
But presumably did really good work.
Exactly. So this is a quote from his website. So basically, quote, since 1982, Carlo Bergman has been spending his winter time in the Libyan desert, mostly walking alone, his camels on his coattails. He followed long-forgotten caravan roads, reading the barren landscape while covering more than 75,000 kilometers on foot rewarded him with exceptional discoveries, end quote. So very cool. One of these exceptional discoveries was the Abu Balas Trail. He basically connected all of the dots of the explorers that had come before him.
Yeah.
And he took a total route of 440 kilometers, like, straight shot, and discovered 27 different pottery sites along the way, uncovering this ancient caravan trail.
Crazy.
Yeah. And it all started with this pottery hill that was similar to that one found by Prince Kamal al-Adin in the 1920s. And this was situated approximately 15 kilometers from Dakhla.
Was that the same one that we had a photo of from episode one, Wow Masi, that all those pots around the... Or is that different?
Because remember, hill scattered with pottery. Good question.
I wonder if that's the same. Because obviously, because al-Qadin and al-Masi were partners. Yeah. And remember, we had that reference to, like, the route to Siwa.
And it says he describes as finding many pots still intact. So that definitely leads me to think that that was the same location. Because he does reference Harding King. He doesn't directly reference Prince Kamal al-Din. But
interesting. Anyway.
Yeah. So, and another really significant aspect of this find was that the pottery was dated using carbon-14 dating to approximately 3,500 years ago. So to me, and to a lot of other people, that sort of displays impressive organizational skills for water resources in ancient times. Whether or not that was coming from ground resources or if they were transporting this water via, like, donkeys and stuff.
Well, and here's the thing about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he traveled, him and obviously al-Masi and Clayton and these guys, they were heading along caravan routes. Like, the Siwa caravan route was more to the northwest,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether or not that the caravan route was directly connected, going further south and curving and going southwest or whatever. But the idea that, obviously, water has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're far enough along this caravan route away from known water sources, mm-hmm. you're not going to be carting water from you know, way further back from the place you originally left from.
Yeah.
It's going to be coming from known water sources along the way. Otherwise, you're going to be expending more resources than it's worth to bring the water back up.
And we should just mention right now, too, the placement of, say, water pots, like, strategic locations along the way, along routes. Because that came up in our first episode, right? With Cambyses. And basically what he did is he had an arrangement with the Arabian king that the Arabians would go and place these water pots filled with water.
Ready to go.
Exactly. Strategic locations so that the army could move across the Sea of Sand without any
issues. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So anyways, yeah. So basically, this Bergman, getting back to him, he discovered this ancient caravan trail that he called the Abu Balas Trail. And then he also discovered the Water Mountain.
Water Mountain.
Which totally refuted all of
all
of King's claims and Baal and all these people that basically said that there couldn't have been an oasis this far south because of the way that the geographic layers, geologic layers, the layers of sandstone and clay were deposited. He said that it basically couldn't hold groundwater,
right?
But this was disproven by Bergman, and basically he found evidence that there was water there.
Yeah,
and that
he didn't just find that there was water there. There were hieroglyph panels inscribed. So that what you're getting to? Hieroglyph panels inscribed on the rock near to where he was during the reign of Khufu's successor.
De Geoffrey.
De Geoffrey. DeGiffre.
DeGiffre.
That sounds like an English name.
It was his son, actually.
Interesting. So anyway, so this was obviously, I mean, I'm honest, quite frankly, I'm not familiar with those two. Those are lesser known.
Yeah, they were from approximately 2700 BCE.
Okay, and probably relatively brief. So this was the
25th, sorry, no.
Which dynasty would that have been?
I think it was the 27th.
I had it written down, and
it says here that basically the hieroglyphic texts, there were these stone slabs arranged in a breathtaking way, and there was all these cartouches with inscriptions from the pharaoh Chufu and his son.
Right.
And basically these were interspersed with pictographs of animals.
Right.
And Bergman interpreted the hieroglyphics, and it basically explained the purpose of these expeditions to this particular site as being part of an effort to quarry pigments. So yes, for dyes and yes, things like that.
Because this was significant. That was mm-hmm. that was really important, not just for artwork and for building things, but necessary for drafting certain things, for putting up, like, it was used for all kinds of different things. So like this idea that they needed to quarry things to use for pigments, which was obviously different, like clay, different things like that. This was so remote. The number of people described that would have been necessary to quarry these types of things would have required a significant water source.
Exactly.
That's a very significant find.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if there was one thing to kind of overarchingly, like, just tie this all together, it's just this idea that every single year that we've looked at from the very beginning, starting with the 14th century, basically, every century you go, people are finding things that they didn't know existed before.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's water source, whether it's a caravan route, whether it's how long that caravan route actually extended,
yeah, and there being exactly. pots
along the way.
Yeah.
So, pretty incredible stuff.
Pretty cool. And just another really hugely significant thing about this water mountain, and again, I did slightly touch on this. So basically, he threw out the whole idea that there wasn't, that this area didn't have the ability for underground water to collect in aquifers, because he found layers of clay coming into light at the rock face of this water mountain. So basically, so it would have penetrated into the sandstone and promoted the development of underground water resources that could have been tapped by ancients or would have formed natural outlets at topographically favorable places.
Hmm.
And apparently there was relics up to 9 meters of this playa, which is native soil that is like a clay. And
interesting.
Yeah, so it was found within this vicinity on top of flat sandstone. So, and just to add to that, in the hieroglyphics that he found, they were basically, he was kind of confused and he thought it was almost like a way to tally or like keep count of something. But then he kind of reassessed it and he basically came to the conclusion that it was a map. And it basically, he theorized that it dated most probably to a late Neolithic period. And this map shows 10 wells and a number of irrigated fields. And two of them are connected with a water source. So
interesting.
Yeah. Very cool. So there you go. And then there's all these irrigated fields with canals connecting them. So basically a Neolithic culture, non-primitive, I would say, if they got frickin' canals and wells and all this stuff.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
Able to find water underground.
But here's the thing. Just because the pectoglyphs seem Neolithic in the sense that we would mm-hmm. have the connotation that it is primitive,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean anything. No. We look at the pyramids and we look at the Egyptian culture, all their history and all their stories and all their writing is two-dimensional hieroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they constructed the three-dimensional pyramids and we have no idea how they did it.
Yeah, right? We have
so writing systems, drawing, what, I suck at drawing. I'm alive in 2018 and I can't draw anything. you know what I mean? But you know what I'm trying to say though, right? Like it doesn't correlate to the
ability.
The ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically what he took this was the first in situ evidence, so in place is what that means, in
right,
situ,
right.
Evidence of an early agricultural report from Neolithic times, which is, I find that fascinating.
Very
I'm just
much,
like,
yeah.
Holy crap, like totally. That just totally explodes all my preconceived ideas of what that would have been like.
Yeah, where we're thinking like, oh, it was only
2500 BC in the later stages of Egypt where it was so advanced or like whatever. It's like, no, this idea that there was could have been something so much more advanced, like predating the Egyptians, is so cool. So cool. And I am beginning to believe it more and more and more that every minute we look at this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory section is going to be fun.
It's going to be. Yeah, it's going to be exciting.
Wrapped up with Bergman, do you think, here?
Yes. We've covered his main findings. And again, we will touch on the implications of those findings in part two.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that. But as of now, we're going to wrap up part one here.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, in this part one, we've covered essentially over 100 years of expeditions. Well over 100 years, when we're thinking about it. So we're all the way back
into 18. And then even before that, like, centuries and centuries of just anecdotal evidence and
totally,
things like that.
Totally. And it is just that. It is secondary source. It's anecdotal. It's there's not much
it's
primary
very fragmentary.
Information.
It's,
but
it depends on a lot of your interpretation.
It too. Does, but... Yeah. People are taking that interpretation however you want it, and then as we move along, they're finding things that corroborate it.
Exactly.
Wadis, trails. It's just mm-hmm. The plot thickens every
it really does.
Every few years.
It's a winding road.
Very very it's awesome. It's super
so
cool.
Anyway, yeah, we hope all you enjoyed listening to this part one.
Yeah.
We are gonna maybe. We've kind of been talking a bit about how we want to structure these episodes from here on out.
Yeah.
And we're thinking it would be a little bit better to organize it in terms of two parts.
It sounds like from the comments we've gotten, everybody seems to want a little bit more detail.
Yeah, more detail, more organization, structure, things like that, which is exactly what I want to give you guys.
Totally.
And basically, so we're thinking we are going to start rolling these out as two-parters.
Yeah.
And they will be released... every week, hopefully.
Yeah. We're going to try our best.
Yeah. So basically we're going to lay it out. So maybe part one is available Sunday. Part two is available on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And so you get to look forward to almost like two episodes every week.
That would be that's the goal.
Yes.
That's the goal. So let us know mm-hmm. what you think about that. You can reach out to us at intotheportalmailbox@gmail.com mm-hmm. or on Facebook.
Yes. Twitter.
Twitter.
We've had a lot of fun on Twitter.
Yeah. Twitter at intotheportal1.
It's my first incursion into Twitter and I'm really enjoying it.
No, it's been awesome. It's been great.
So yeah. And then basically we definitely want to encourage you to leave your review if you'd like.
If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review.
We've gotten such awesome feedback so far. We're just really stoked on that. But give us your review, iTunes, Google Play, or your fave platform, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
We are definitely, make sure you go to the website, check out the new look. We've done a little bit of a redesign.
Amber updated the logo. I'm in digging it.
I did, yeah. That was my Sunday last weekend. Anyways. And then also as well, we're going to be updating the resources page so you can find all these sources that we've mentioned and more, including the bookstore update. So there's going to be some fun books. I've got... 3 or 4 different ones.
If you're interested in ancient Egypt or anything like this and lost anything and just mm-hmm. cool stuff, go check out our bookstore. There's awesome resources on there.
Yeah, definitely. And then as well, look forward to that blog post because that'll be up too.
Amber's been working hard on that.
Yeah. No. Anyways, so we're going to leave it at that, I think.
Yeah. So. Thank you so much, you guys, again. And
we will be back
very shortly.
Exactly. Look forward to it.
With part two. Talk to you guys soon.
See ya.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi there, my name's Andy.
And my name's Anna.
And we are two of the four hosts of the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish. We present every week the most amazing, wonderful, insane, hilarious, bizarre facts you've ever heard.
Facts like, did you know America has a national grocery bag packing competition?
Did you know, Anna, the company Volkswagen sells more sausages than it does cars?
Yes, we've got those two facts and about a billion more in our podcast archives for you to listen to. We chat about them, we laugh about them, we make the occasional terrible pun.
It's great fun. It's called No Such Thing as a Fish. Why don't you listen now?